know if Brent shared this with you. If you recall, that last 2 weeks of that unit we replaced was there, they lost 4 soldiers.
Yeah.
But I remember kind of doing a debrief after, and some of these young kids that were with us, and you could see that light click on kind of in their head, if you will, this terrible thing, but where they were like, okay, this isn't like the games we play,
yeah,
where you just hit reset and go, this is real. People are really trying to kill us, and this is serious business.
Welcome to another episode of Relentlessly Resilient, presented by Minky Couture.
We are so happy to have Minky Couture as the sponsor of Relentlessly Resilient. My kids and I have several of them, and they are so good for cuddling up on cold winter nights. Minky makes the softest, most indulgent blankets. They make the best gifts, and the only gift I give out anymore. Visit Minky in-store or online at minkycouture.com. Treat yourself or a loved one to the gift of comfort today.
The podcast where real people share real life experiences and the tools they develop to move forward and live their best life. I'm Michelle Scharf.
And I'm Jenny Taylor. And today we have a friend that I've known for a couple of decades.
Ooh.
Sergeant Major of the Utah Army National Guard, retired now, Garrett Johnston. Garrett, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Jenny.
All right. I'm going to tell our audience how far back we go, because it has been a very long time. What rank would you have been in the days of that first deployment with my husband?
First deployed, I was a Staff Sergeant E6, and then I got promoted in Iraq to Sergeant First Class E7.
Okay. Back a long time ago in 2007, my husband was a young lieutenant, just straight out of commissioning, straight out of ROTC, and he and another 160 or so men from across the state of Utah all volunteered to become part of an ad hoc unit for a deployment to Iraq through the Utah Army National Guard. It was not a set unit. It was a kind of a special mission that needed to be taken place with convoy security, moving goods from point A to point B. And that's where our family's paths first crossed. And now, you know, nearly almost 2 decades later, we've continued to cross paths. Unfortunately, some of our most recent reunions have been either my husband's funeral or funerals for other soldiers from that same unit for various circumstances. But today we want to talk a little bit, Garrett, with you about your career. You have this beautiful career as a soldier, but you've also had a career in law enforcement. And I recently saw a post you shared on LinkedIn about the beautiful intersection you've been able to find where there's light and goodness, even in the middle of war and law enforcement and some of those things that take us to more of a negative connotation. So I'm really excited to explore that path today and how you found that light, how you found and flexed the muscle of resilience. So in order to get started, I would love to ask you the question we ask all of our guests. What does resilience mean to you?
Yeah, thanks, Jenny. So resilience for me, I remember when it kind of came around, it was a real buzzword, even in the military, about a decade and a half ago, and they started realizing that soldiers needed this resilience to, especially when we were in the middle of wartime and being able to deal with that and then deal with just the pressures of life. So they started teaching resilience to soldiers. And I actually was one of the first people to go through what they call the Master Resiliency Trainer, or MRT course, to learn more about it. And that's where I truly learned what the meaning of resiliency was. But for me, it's just being able to, you know, we're going to have adversity and trials and struggles and hardships in our lives. And that's inevitable. Some we bring upon ourselves and some we can't control, but it's the ability to overcome those adversities in our life, and not just overcome them and endure them, but also be strengthened by them to where we're able to overcome that trial and hardship, and then be able to, for me at least, be able to give back to others that are struggling or going through something similar later down the road. So that's really what being resilient means to me.
Yeah, and that's what I love about you, is kind of that give back to where maybe you've developed that resilience muscle through your own life's experiences, and you're not just sitting back flexing that muscle, but you're helping others strengthen theirs. So walk us through your career path a little bit. You have had a career that has led you through almost resilience as a necessity. I don't think you could have had either career that you've had for these years had you not been able to really develop those tools of resilience. So can you just maybe introduce your family life a little bit, your personal background, and then walk us through this career where you've had kind of that dual uniform in both the law enforcement and the military side of things?
Absolutely. Well, on the personal side, so happily married to the love of my life, Sydney Johnston. We just celebrated on New Year's Eve our 14-year wedding anniversary.
Congratulations. So
thank you. We have a mixed family. She and I both came in our marriage, having been married before and had kids, which is a challenge for many, you know.
Sure.
And so resiliency is really come into play in our marriage and being able to combine these family units and
how many kiddos between the two of you?
So 8 total. We have one together, Tatum. He's 10. But our kids range from my oldest is 31 down to Tatum is 10 years old. So, and we've got 6 grandkids.
Well, that's its own conversation on resilience right there. I'm just laughing because of that. And blended families are no light matter. I mean, sometimes the marriage doesn't work because of the blended.
Of the kids.
Sure. Exactly. So, all right. Sorry. Carry on. You've got this beautiful, wonderful wife now, strong marriage, beautiful blended family with its own lessons of resilience.
Yes, absolutely. And I can tell you the difference in this one, because, you know, I mean, even you look at marriage statistics nowadays on first marriages, you know, the rates aren't very good. So we kind of knew getting into this that we had a challenge. But I can tell you just to kind of segue a little bit, but definitely the gospel in our life and in our home and our religion has definitely been what's strengthened us and held us together and given us the resiliency that we need, because it hasn't always been easy, especially the first couple of years. I was not an easy person to be with because of some of the PTSD issues I was having from combat and things like that. But we'll get into that a little bit later.
Sure, interested to learn more for sure.
Yeah. That's me on a personal note. We live in Santa Quinn. Love it here. I knew from a very young age, you know, kids have these dreams of what they want to be when they grew up. And I wanted to be a police officer and a soldier. And for me, I felt very blessed that I have had the opportunity to fulfill both those dreams and to do both. I'm a 7th generation member of the military, direct lineage in my Johnston side of the family. So it was just something
seven
I knew
generations.
I wanted to do.
I did not know that about you. How far back does that go?
All the way back to the Revolutionary.
Oh my. Yeah.
That is amazing.
That's remarkable. Okay, carry on. So you knew from a young age you didn't want to break that chain.
Yeah. And I was the only out of my cousins and siblings and everything to end up serving. So, and then my oldest son served in the Utah National Guard for a while too.
That's
so
neat.
He's carried that legacy on. So far it's been unbreakable. My dad, everyone was in the Army except for my dad. He joined the Navy. We don't hold that against him. He still serves. But
except for when you hold it against him, let's be honest, as a true soldier,
okay.
I'd say.
Yeah. But yeah, so right out of, actually in high school, so back then, I actually wanted to be a Marine. And my parents didn't like that idea so much. And I was 17, and they had to sign a waiver for me to join. So the deal was, we'll sign this waiver at 17 for you to join, but we want you to join the National Guard to give military life a try. So I said, okay.
So that was kind of their compromise for your minor age.
I don't know what mother actually ever wants to hear their child say, I want to be Marine.
Yeah.
In all fairness. Sounds like a good deal to me as a mom.
Yeah.
So I'll meet you in the middle.
Spanish Fork. And so I ended up joining the artillery unit that was in Spanish Fork at the time to become a field artilleryman. So one of my friends, Brady Harrison, also served. He's retired master sergeant. His dad was my recruiter, Mark Harrison, who's also retired active duty master sergeant. But so I joined the artillery unit, Spanish Fork, and it was a little different then. Nowadays, when you join before you ship off or old enough to ship off to basic training, they'll have you come do your weekend drills where they kind of give you the pre-taste of what basic training is like. Then when I joined, they just let you start drilling with your unit until you graduated high school and shipped off. So I was going with the men in that unit for several months. I joined in March of 1992. And then right after I graduated high school In May, I shipped off for basic training to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, 17 years old, turned 18 while I was there.
Talk to us a little bit about that. I imagine there's some fairly mandatory resilience training at boot camp, especially straight out of high school.
Back then, not really. They do now, but back in 1992, I don't recall anything as far as resilience training. It was just you got there and they broke you down so they could build you up to what the Army wanted you to be type of thing. And I was kind of a cocky, arrogant kid and thought I was pretty tough, and I needed that as more than anyone. It was kind of funny, though. I remember the drill sergeants, because, you know, they're pretty intimidating, right, when you get off the – but they actually have you on cattle cars, they call them. They're really these big things that they load cattle on. But they put soldiers on them with your duffel bag, and as soon as you get off to meet the drill sergeants, just swarm on you like bees, and they just get in your face, and they start yelling at you, and they got you doing push-ups and this whole intimidation factor. And I remember thinking – man, I had a head football coach that was more intimidating than you guys. I didn't say that, of course, but so I had a little bit of resilience.
You were too tough for boot camp.
Yeah. But I think I was just that some of the resiliency I had just from growing up with sports and some tough coaches and things like that too. But I went there. I excelled, ended up being the platoon guide, one of the honor grads at basic training. So my military career started out great. And then I came back, and again, I was just a normal National Guardsman where it's one weekend a month. And then I went down after I got back from basic training. I came home 4 hours after. So I did basic training AIT, which is your advanced individual training for my specialty, my MOS, which is military occupational specialty. So I was a 13 Bravo, which is a cannon crew member of an artillery unit. And then I enrolled to go down to Snow College. I had a walk-on football scholarship down there. But I also came home to a son that was born 4 hours before I got off the plane in Salt Lake City.
Oh, my goodness. Your first baby.
Yeah, my first baby.
Wow. Okay.
So.
Almost got back in time.
Yeah, almost got back in time.
Talk for a bit. While you're in the Guard, is this when you went into law enforcement and then you were doing National Guard kind of on the side? Or where does that law enforcement piece come in the first time?
Yeah, so I was a traditional part-time National Guardsman for about the first 11 years of my career. At that time, I worked in construction for a while as a foreman, and then I went into law enforcement at the age 24. I started working for the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office for 2 years up in the Salt Lake County Jail. So that was in 98. And then in 2000, I hired on with the Salt Lake City Police Department full time as a police officer. And I was with them until 2005. I had a deployment, my first deployment in 2003 to 2004 in support of the War on Terror. And then in 2005, I had the opportunity to go active duty with the Utah Army National Guard full-time. So I left my law enforcement career, put it on hold, I guess. And then I served 20 years active duty with the military.
What can you tell us about that first deployment? Where did you go? What was the nature of the work? Is that where you experienced maybe some of the difficulties that were kind of giving you some trouble later? Or did that come up in the 07-08 deployment?
More of the 07-08. So we weren't sure when we first got our grazing herd, as you know. So grazing herd's kind of that, the first warning that you're going to get deployed. And then it turns into what they call a raging bull in the military, which is, okay, get your stuff. This is where you're going. So we weren't sure. And that was when the war on terror in Iraq had first kicked off.
Yeah.
As you can remember. So we were pretty sure. And kind of the rumor and the words we were getting was that that's where we were going. But as things started to spin up a little bit more, we got reassigned and we ended up doing a homeland security mission. So it was kind of funny because we got deployed to the Deseret Chemical Depot in our home state of
Karen
Tooele, Utah, to do a security mission to protect, because that's when they still had chemicals and things that they were destroying out there.
People by and large across the state of Utah don't know everything that happens at Tooele and Dugway both. They're kind of obscure. They're a little off the beaten path, but they were very instrumental, particularly during that global war on terrorism time frame and early on. So did you live at home, or were you out at Tooele full time? How does that look when you're in your home on deployment?
Yes and yes. So we mobilized to Fort Carson, Colorado. So we did our normal mob site training for 3 months out there, to where you get all your immunizations and the training you need based upon your mission. And then, we were three. They call them our green, amber, and red cycle. So on our green days, we were out there where we're actually on the Deseret Chemical Depot, and we were in fighting positions. We were basically guarding that facility because, as far as the Department of Defense was, that was a site that could be of particular interest to people that
because
didn't have
of
the
everything
best
stored
in the
there.
Nation. Yeah, absolutely. So that was our mission, to be out there and guard it. And then we had three training days where we were at Teed, or the Tooele Army Depot, not too far from Deseret Chemical Depot, where we had trained for 3 days, and then we'd have 3 days off where we were on call, and then we'd go home and be with our family. So really, I was like, for that year, living out of a bag, because you were just three days here, three days there. Yeah, so that was interesting. It was good and bad, because some of us kind of emotionally, we're getting spun up to go into combat.
Yeah.
And you know the emotions that brings, preparing for
and
that.
And the uncertainty, sure.
And that, and then to not can be good and bad. For some of us, it's like, well, that's kind of what I wanted to do. I signed up for this. So, but it had its own challenges, but it was still a good experience. We got a lot of good, valuable training. And so that was my first deployment.
Okay. Can you walk us through that second one in when you did go to Iraq, and what was that like? Let's keep the resilience lens here. I remember, because we were fairly young, Brent and I, we had two little babies at the time, but Brent seemed to be one of the older members of that unit, relatively speaking. There were some young guys shipping off. We're now 6 or 7 years into the global war on terrorism. You've recruited volunteer soldiers from all across the state, literally, like the smallest, most obscure towns into the big cities. Walk us through that, and maybe any particular lessons of resilience or opportunities, good or bad, on that time.
So as you alluded to, it was an all-volunteer mission. So normally when a unit deploys, they pick this unit that they exist. Okay, well, you guys are deploying, and you're going here to do this. Well, this was a special mission, as you talked about. It was actually a very dangerous mission, and that's why the tag at the time, General Tarbert, didn't want to make it. He wanted to make it an all-volunteer one. And usually when that happens, you'd think, well, you're not going to be able to fill it. We actually had so many people volunteer, we had to turn people away. We had to cut some people out and not take with us, which was pretty neat to see the patriotism and the volunteerism of people that wanted to go. But again, I had been wanting to serve my country. And at the time, I was a leadership trainer. I worked there at the Regional Training Institute at Camp Williams, teaching leadership courses to non-commissioned officers. And I wanted the opportunity to test myself in combat. And that's kind of what you do this for. As bad as it may sound, that's really what the military trains for, to fight and win our nation's wars.
Right.
And I wanted that opportunity to serve my nation. So I signed up immediately when I had the opportunity to serve. And I remember Brent was a young lieutenant, but he was not as young. We had literally had a bunch of people in our platoon were these teenage kids, very, very young, had no idea of, I think, really what they were getting themselves into. And resiliency was something that was huge. And they had to kind of learn on the fly, if you will. I remember, just fast forward a little bit, because they picked a few of us, a handful of us, to go advance party, as you recall, Jenny, and me and Brent were two of those people.
Yeah, you arrived a couple weeks ahead of the rest of the group, right? Maybe 3 weeks or so?
Yeah, so we got to Kuwait before they did, and we weren't in Kuwait as long. They just did a speedy training on us there, and then they got us on the ground in Iraq with the unit we were replacing, so that we could learn the routes and the mission and the rules of engagement, rules of force, and train the rest of our unit when they arrived there behind us. And I don't know if Brent shared this with you. If you recall, that last 2 weeks of that unit we replaced was there, they lost 4 soldiers.
Yeah.
One was to suicide and 3 were to IED blast. And I was on 2 of those convoys when 2 of the soldiers died. As a matter of fact, one of the gentlemen that was driving, he was driving for Lieutenant Allison, which was one of the platoon leaders in one of the other platoons that got sent home.
Right.
Because he lost.
He was one of our guys.
One of ours, because some of the shrapnel took out his ear canal where he couldn't hear and he lost some sight too. But I remember pulling that soldier that was driving for him. So it was that soldier's last mission. We were on our way back. He had a wife and 2 young boys at home and a brand new daughter they had not met yet.
Is this Travis Bachman?
Yeah, and we had to pull him out of that vehicle and literally in 2 pieces because the IED had split his body in half. So I was on that and helped pull him out. But I remember kind of doing a debrief after with just the set 4 guys after we did the main one and some of these young kids that were with us. And you could see that light click on kind of in their head, if you will, this terrible thing, but where they were like, okay, this isn't like the games we play,
yeah,
where you just hit reset and go, this is real. People are really trying to kill us. And this is life and death. And I remember seeing that expression on their faces. And then when the rest of the unit got there and we briefed them on it, seeing that they realized, wow, this isn't a game. They lost 4 soldiers in the last 2 weeks. And this is serious business. And the resilience that it takes, that you have to build, whether you've had training on that or experience, to be able to endure it is something that I've seen each of those soldiers develop and build. And I think it was more for a lot of them. It wasn't even for themselves. It was they wanted to be resilient and strong so they could take care of their battle buddies, the other soldiers to the left and right in their vehicle with them. That is something that you'll see in both military and law enforcement. Almost the self-preservation isn't as important as it is to the safety of your brothers and sisters wearing your uniform. And I don't think you see that in a lot of career fields to where you're willing to.
And it takes a certain person, a certain personality type to say, or even without saying it with words, but to live in such a way that you would put that person at your left or right, even before yourself. Can you tell us a little bit, you go through that deployment, 4 soldiers from the unit you were replacing died very quickly right toward the end of their time. You guys served the better part of a year over in Iraq and didn't lose anyone to combat in terms of death. Can you talk about maybe some of the resilience, you as one of the leaders in that unit of very young men, wide-eyed and new to the world of war, how did you help them or yourself kind of develop some of that resilience? And maybe what were some of the lessons learned through that combat time that you were there?
Well, for me, you know, every leader has their own way of leading. For me and Brent, we are very similar. And that's, I think, why we did so well together with our platoon, me as the platoon sergeant, him as the platoon leader. After the mission, yeah, the mission first, soldier always, you hear that, which means mission accomplishment first, and then your soldiers. But when the mission was over, we genuinely took the time to, I don't know if befriend's the word, because we're still in a leadership position, but to truly take the time to be around our soldiers and to show them that we care about them as an individual. They are more than just a name tag and a number. And you'll see that in a lot of the military. Well, I think even a lot of civilian corporations where the bottom line is what's most important, and people kind of forget we're human beings and what makes us tick. And we took the time to really find and learn more about each person as an individual and to show them that we cared about them. And to find their strengths and weaknesses, those strengths and weaknesses to help make them a stronger and better soldier and also more resilient while we were there. Because, I mean, you're dealing with combat, the stresses of that, the lack of sleep and all the things, and still you have all the stressors that were going on at home. You know, my wife at the time had filed for divorce while I was over there, and a lot of the soldiers had no idea. I didn't want it to affect them. And I just bring that up because there were a lot of people that were going through just personal issues too that were
hard
on them.
You don't leave the rest of life at home simply because you've gone to war.
Absolutely. So all those stresses, whether it's financial or marital or relationships, in spite of going out and not knowing if you're going to make it back that night, you know, so resiliency was something that they were developing and getting, whether they realized it or not.
Right. It's not a buzzword anymore. It's survival.
Absolutely.
What did it look like when you got home? You got home, it's 2008. Now it's 2024. Walk us through the second half of your military career. You mentioned you were full-time for the National Guard. Maybe explain that, because I think most of us default to a National Guardsman is by nature a part-time soldier.
So when we got home was when, and like you alluded to, we brought every one of our men and women home, some worse for wear. Adam Santome got medevac out of there that was in our platoon, but everyone came home alive. But that's where some of the scars from war start, and maybe some of the, I don't want to say lack of resiliency, but we started to really see the toll that that year took on our soldiers, because we started to have the suicides, as you know, has continued even up until recently with our soldiers that have went on that deployment. So some of the horrors that haunt soldiers after going into combat. So it was a great thing to bring them all home, but there's still many.
The battle doesn't end.
And just in general, the battle doesn't end. So that's just something I think we need to remember for those that we love and that we know that serve, that they still have battles going on inside of their head. But so for me, I got back and I went back to work at the Regional Training Institute. And then, of course, I've moved around with promotions and different unit assignments throughout my career. So ultimately culminating into being promoted to E9 Sergeant Major, which is the top enlisted rank in the Army. I attended the United States Sergeant Major's Academy out at Fort Bliss. That's a 2-year school, a lot of academic. And then last April, well, the end of April, first part of May, I retired with a little over 20 years of active duty and 31 years of total military service.
That's a lot of years.
Yeah. And it goes by quick. As long as that seems, it's crazy. I look back and like, it went by in a flash.
So here's what I want to ask for a few minutes now. You've served this career where you've acknowledged that you yourself struggled with some of these maybe invisible battles or the battles that continue outside of the war zone. You and I both know that we've collectively from that unit, everyone came home alive from the deployment. Not everyone has stayed alive since. Unfortunately, we lost another to suicide very, very recently. You came out of the military with a lot of leadership. You had developed a lot of resilience. It seemed that whatever difficulties and those darknesses you'd been able to find through your faith and your spouse and just, you know, you've learned to really exercise that muscle of resilience. Offered a great corporate job through Walmart, largely, you know, one of the largest corporations in the world. How long did you last at Walmart and why did you leave?
Oh, so yeah, the pay was well. Everything was good. I liked the people at Walmart. I was there for about 4 months. Yeah, they had actually kind of recruited me.
Great executive opportunity.
Yeah, I had huge growth. They had plans for where I was going to be in a year, and huge pay raise, and I was mentoring and trying to develop people I was working with, but I would come home and I just like tell Sydney, I'm like, this isn't for me. Like, I don't feel like I'm giving what I can. I feel like I have more to give and more to offer, and I'm not able to do it in this position. So after some begging and pleading with her, because she didn't want me to go back into a dangerous field into law enforcement. I'd gotten out of the military. So we kind of compromised. And she said, if I did, it needed to be somewhere in Utah County where we live, because before I worked up in Salt Lake County, and the smallest apartment I could find. And at the time, I got on Indeed, and Linden Police Department was hiring. I didn't know they had a department, and that's where I got hired. And there were 16 of us, including the chief. It's right between Orem and Pleasant Grove, and I cannot tell you how fulfilling each and every day is for me to be able to go and feel like that I am contributing and giving back to the community and making even the smallest of differences in my corner of the world. And I think that's really, for me, where I find being able to be resilient and strengthen myself is through service. I love to be able to serve.
I wonder what the connection between the military, I think about this often, we lose so many military people to suicide. They come, either they're still in active duty service, but maybe not, it's maybe not full-time or whatever. There's mm-hmm. a variety of situations, but you just hit on something that I often wonder about. Part of resiliency is connection and contribution.
Yes.
And being able to feel like you're contributing in a significant way. And I wonder if sometimes we don't really connect the dots when our military people come home and that they aren't finding a way to connect and feel like they're making a true contribution. Because when you are serving in the military, it is on some level such an honor. We have a different perspective of those who serve today than we used to in this country. And so there's some honor in that in and of itself. And I just wonder if sometimes the connection that we're not making in this whole process with our military is providing enough contribution and connection.
I think you're spot on. Obviously, you know, not having done any studies or have a doctorate in that or anything, I, at least for me personally, I think, you know, after you've been contributing and feel like, man, I'm making a difference, and then all of a sudden for it to shut off, I think can be very hard. I found that for me, even transitioning in the military sector. And I was trying to find ways to give back and still serve, and I still serve in my calling in the church and things like that. But I feel like sometimes you feel like there's more you can and want to do. And I think if we can maybe find ways for service members, especially after combat deployments, to do that and feel like they're still valued, I
right.
think would be a huge way to help lower our suicide numbers. And I just feel, for me, my greatest reward, there's just something about serving others in any capacity that is just so fulfilling and rewarding that I can't describe it, but it's more important to me than a salary or money or things like that. The payment I get from feeling like I made a difference in what I did.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone
so
thinks
more rewarding.
Military service is all that lucrative. And so
yeah,
I don't,
right. Certainly neither is law enforcement.
and that's true either. But I think the missing piece there is that if you're doing something that you feel is creating value for your community and that you're serving in a way that is truly serving others, then it creates this value that is somewhat intangible in ways. And I just feel like that's the missing piece. And I don't have a doctorate in resiliency either, but I do study it a lot. And I do talk to people about resiliency and how to develop it. And it just seems like that's the big missing piece. And I love that you brought it up, that you went and found a job that was lucrative. The pay was well. It was all great, except that you didn't feel like you were really contributing in a significant way that mattered to you.
Yes.
And I would say it's which comes first, the chicken or the egg? Does the military give you that thirst for service and meaningful, passionate work? Or were you drawn to the military because you had that thirst for meaningful, passionate work? Do you know what I mean? And I'd love to spend our last few minutes, if we can, Garrod, talk about how you've been able to find that light and see the good in a world full of combat and crime and law enforcement. I was really just impacted by what you shared on that LinkedIn post that sounds like maybe wasn't how you've always seen it, that it's not just you kind of preaching to everybody else that you've had this picture perfect rosies pair of glasses forever, but maybe how you've learned to see that good even in the middle of war and difficult circumstances in your career.
Absolutely. So, you know, when I was a younger officer and soldier kind of in that post, and I think I was more jaded, more pessimistic, and it was easy when I was surrounded by so much darkness, so much evil and hate and crime or whatever it is in the world to just kind of view the world in general as that way. And I actually found myself starting to do that and starting to see the bad, like trying to see the bad in everything and everyone. And I didn't like the person that was making me become. Now, at that time, I had also, you know, in my religious affiliation, I had fallen away from the church and things like that. And I wasn't as close to my Savior. And I think obviously that played a huge role in it. As I've matured and experienced more things in life, to include my own personal difficulties, whether it be war or through my occupations or from losing a child, as you know, it's brought me much closer to my Father in heaven and my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, and trying to put on, see people and situations through our Savior's eyes, regardless of what the situation is or what the person's done, has really helped me to try and find the good in all situations, even the worst of situations. I had an opportunity a couple weeks ago when I took a gentleman to jail that had, well, we don't need to get into that, but he started talking to me on the way to jail, and I don't know how it got brought up, but he said, "Are you Christian?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, are you Mormon? And I said, "Yes." And we had this great talk on the way, and we talked about the atonement and repentance. And after we got to the jail, you know, they searched him in, and then they had him come sit back down by me as I'm filling out paperwork. And we continued this conversation. And I told this gentleman, he was from Argentina, but he spoke pretty good English. I said, "Look at me in the eyes." And he did. And I said, "If you think me sitting here wearing this uniform makes me any better than you, and that you don't think I have my own demons and my own things that I need to overcome or my own sins, or you think I need Jesus Christ any less than you, you're wrong. And you are loved by him just as much as I am." And then he asked me if he could give me a hug before I left. And I did. And that was a huge rewarding day for me. And those are the kind of things I'm talking about. But for me, it was to be able to go into these situations and just try and see people the way the Savior would see them, regardless of what they've done or what they're in, whether they're the victim, whether the suspect or anyone else, has been a huge game changer for me. And something that's really helped me to find the good in the world. The world is a seemingly darker place. There's more contention each and every day, and I think it's sometimes hard to see the light and the good, and I think it's important for us to try and shine that light and be that light where and when we can.
Absolutely.
I love that. I love how you've been able to take your personal life experiences that have been highs and lows. You mentioned very briefly the loss of your daughter, and that could be a whole other conversation we didn't get to today. Your experience in combat, your experience with different people in law enforcement, your experience with divorce and blended family. We could make a list. Take that personal experience, combine it with your personal perspective of faith and how that's helped you not just flex the muscle of resilience, but live in a way where you're trying to see people through maybe a kinder set of eyes, less judgment, more acceptance. You've been able to find hope in your own life, and now you're more inclined to want to share that hope with others. I think that's beautiful and just sums up resilience so well. Thank you for sharing everything you've shared with us today. I would love to continue this conversation another time and learn more about that deployment when you and my husband and so many of those young men were off across the world and maybe talking through, kind of like Michelle said, how do we help those who've returned from war to still find that purpose and belonging? How do we help them not just survive the battle in combat zones, but continue to survive the day-to-day battles? So thank you for the work you're doing. I know you're tireless in helping the men and women in all kinds of uniforms around you. And I just appreciate the light and the hope that you bring. So thank you so much for sharing that with us today.
Thank you, Jenny. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate what you've shared with us today as well. If you like what you've heard, you can subscribe for free to our podcast, wherever you find your podcast. And please try to give us a rating and review. It really helps us in our rankings and helps people find us. If you know someone who has a real story about real life that they're willing to share, go ahead and send us an email at rrpodcast@ksl.com. You can also find us on Instagram and Facebook. On Instagram, we're Relentlessly Resilient Podcast. On Facebook, Relentlessly Resilient. And on either platform, you can follow a link to book a time to have a 15-minute pitch session with me to share your story and see if it's a fit for our show. We'd love to hear your story and see if it works and get you as a guest on our show.
And remember, whatever you do today, remember to be kind. You have no idea the struggles others are dealing with in their lives. Have a great day, everybody.